Thank you. This is going to be a long talk. It has probably some things in it for everybody. And just be patient and wait until the end. There's a message for everything.
So all the equations?
No, I'm going to put all of the equations in the gray area. Because they are gray and very light, so you don't see the equations. Okay. So here are some, big pictures, and try to unify many things. For example, can nuclear clusters around HENs be affected by accretion disks? How can high redshift of quasars to be so metal rich? What causes the emergence of a disk of young stars around the galactic center? How do HEM become inactive? Can fraction of the gravitational wave events be due to occurrence around HENs? Can we learn something about HENs and massive black hole formation and evolution from gravitational wave events? So here's following your example. Ask not what HEN can do for gravitational waves, but ask what gravitational waves and planet formation can do for HENs. So you think these are all very loosely connected and maybe not connected subjects, and let me just very briefly review and try to show you that they're all very intimately connected. HENs is known for more than 50 years when it was first discovered in the 60s. And one of the first innovative idea that came up was that from Lyndon Bell, who felt that HEN could be powered by disk accretion onto massive black holes. Today we know that there's unified models for HENs along this level, and maybe massive black hole has been directly imaged. Okay, so, and the accretion disk model goes back also 50 years in attempts to understand, well, actually more than 50 years, the first really serious work that most people have never came across and read it because it was written in German. It was by Luce in 1952, and 52 in Germany was not a good time. And, but it was very, very sophisticated analysis. And later on by Shakur and Sanyaf and Lindenbaum Pringle had done a lot of this. And the best evidence for accretion disk is found around NGC 4258. And there's a maser right in the center. And there's a definite planar geometry with a Keplerian speed. And so based on that kind of information, we build our models. So, and nuclear cluster has also been discovered. Around center of around massive black holes, the best example is that of the galactic center. There's a disk of young stars, which is called the disk stars. These are four million years old. And there's another group, which is called the S stars. These are the ones that and people observe proper motions of the stars and to measure the mass of the black hole. And those are a little bit older, and I'll come back to these later. But what is interesting is that this age is comparable to the age what people thought to be caused the Fermi bubble, which is above and below the galactic plane, and as if though something has gone out, and maybe there's a connection. So folks has done extensive surveys of host galaxies of massive stars. Today we have evidence to suggest that around every galaxy there's a massive black hole, and very often that you see coexistence of massive black hole and nuclear cluster, and with density cusp that goes way, way in, and you can measure the relative mass between the nuclear cluster and the central black hole for the L-star type of galaxies like the Milky Way. In fact, the cluster can outweigh the black hole by about a factor of 10. And their coexistence is fairly well established for the lower mass late type galaxies, but not so much for the early type very bright quasars, because quasar outshines the surrounding region or the stellar dynamic has been affected. So this is what the message I want to bring across to you. And after this slide, you can sleep until the end, and because I will use this slide again. So I'm going to make an assumption of three things I think everybody agrees on. There's a massive black hole in every galaxy, and that around each massive black hole, there's a nuclear cluster, and the AGN occurs when the massive black hole is fed by accretion disk. So now the most natural question to ask, if you accept these three quote-unquote facts, is what happens when the disk comes on and you have the stars going through the disk, and exactly what happens during that time, okay? And most of the star goes through the disk at over 1,000 kilometers per second. Even at 1 parsec, it's 1,000, and closer in, it's even larger. So that's larger than escape velocity from the surface of the star. And so they go through the disk as if nothing is there. But there are a few stars in any given phase space that has low inclination orbit, nearly circular orbit. So the relative motion relative to the gas is relatively small. And as a result, they have larger gravitational cross-section, or the boundary radius, if you like, and which enables them to feel the drag effect from the disk gas each time they pass through. So there is a fraction at steady rate of these stars gets trapped into the disk. Once they're trapped in the disk, the density of the disk is at least 5 to 6 orders of magnitude larger than the densest molecular clouds that we find around the Milky Way in the interstellar medium. So they can accrete like crazy, even though the temperature is above 10 to the 4 degrees. So they evolve off the main sequence and very quickly, and they pollute this environment with high metallicity, and then they produce stellar mass black holes, like solar mass or so.
Could you give an idea of
I'm going to. Everything you're going to ask, I'm going to. Okay. So,
could you give me all of your personal wealth?
Right, your firstborn child.
Are there studies about the evolution of stars accreting at that rate? And how they evolve, whether they
could yeah, just wait for a moment. Okay. And this is something that we'll come to. So you produce single black holes and with solar mass, but these guys are trapped again in the disk, and they accrete to grow more than an order of magnitude in mass, and they find companions. It's kind of like living species when they're first born, and by the time they reach maturity, they grow by a factor of 10 or more, and they find companions. And in a very similar way, they do this, and then in this environment, these companions interact with the disk and with each other, and their binary separation tightens, and eventually they may merge to produce gravitational waves. That's a cartoon picture. I'm going to now get into the quantitative issues that you ask. To start off with, I want to provide some motivation that to give you a connection between AGNs, not only gravitational wave, AGNs and planet formation. You think these are two such a large scale, and how could they be similar? If I now draw on the black, here is planetary system and galactic center here. If I look at the mass ratio of the planets to the stars, and it's about 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3. And if I look at the mass ratio of these S stars and these stars to the central black hole, it's about 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3. I look at the period of the planets here. It's, we all know, it's what defines a year. And there, the fact that astronomers can find these proper motions and complete orbit of S stars in their career lifetime tells you is the periods of order decades and perhaps up to millennia. The radius of the planets to their semi-major axis, that ratio is 10 to the minus 4. The radius of the star, S stars, to their semi-major axis is 10 to the minus 5. So let's look at the disks. The mass of the disk to the mass of the star in protostellar disk is of order a few percent. And I would show you evidence to suggest the mass of the disk to their host stars, host black holes mass is of order a few percent. The aspect ratio, H over R, is of order a few percent. Again, here is of order a few percent. The gravitational stability parameter, normally referred to as Thom Rees Q, and is order a few in both cases. And the persistent time scale is of order a few million years for protostellar disks. For AGN disks, it's a few million to 100 million years. So there's incredible amount of, you know, parallel, and the question is, are the physics very similar? Of course, the speed is very different, and of course, the temperature in the surrounding region is a bit different, but these scales tells you that there ought to be some scaling law. So if I'm gonna work out things like accretion disk, I need to know something about its surface density, temperature, and distribution and accretion rate, and that would tell me about the capture rate and the evolution towards a massive star and the formation rate for black holes and the contamination. If you look at nuclear clusters in the central region, it will tell me about stellar density, so that tells me about the accretion rate, the trapping rate, and it tells me something about the dynamical property, and it can connect to the host galaxy. Everything here, I'm going to make a connection with the host galaxy, which is observable. Okay, let's start.
And the question is about all those properties of, especially the AGN, like you mentioned, the disk mass.
Yes. Just wait for one more minute.
I'm curious, is that coming from theory or observation?
Just one more minute. Okay.
And then I'll also accept your credit.
Yes, yes. Right. So, this is a good question in the sense that people have developed all the theory. Let's throw the theory out. And let's focus on what observations are telling us. So we, after all these years, there's been digital Sloan survey, and now we have thousands of AGNs to work with, more. And we can work out from the AGN luminosity function and as a function of redshift. And from that evolution function, and you basically you see this evolving system, you can work out the growth rate of black holes from the center. So, and because they're a luminosity function and there's a mass associated with it, you can relate this to the Eddington factor and you can relate this to the efficiency factor. And people have done this for the last 20 years in this game, and they find that the Eddington factor is typically of order, you know, 0.6, a half, right around this region, and the efficiency factor is of order a few percent. And this is empirical. Okay, so now from that, we can see what we can do with regard to a steady state disk. Suppose we have so much ignorance, let's leave that ignorance hidden in this so-called alpha parameter. You can write down the equation for steady state, and then you can characterize the entire disk in three parameters. One is this so-called alpha that many people speculate, And the other is what is called aspect ratio, H. And the third is the Q, the gravitational stability parameter. So from the fact that we are limiting Eddington, the accretion rate during active phase of AGNs, active phase, I should mention that these population synthesis model for AGNs includes lots of inactive phase and the active phase. Okay, so the inactive phase we're not concerned with at this moment. It's active phase we're interested, and for many, many different studies they get essentially very similar results.
Well, and the distinction is just accretion,
or what is the result? Yeah, whether there's whether you get very.
Is there a threshold, or is it?
There's no distribution that tells you exactly there's a threshold, but the galactic center, for example, the Eddington factor is 10 to the minus 3 or minus 4. And there are many quiescent, dormant AGNs. There are 99% black holes are dormant. 1% are in AGN phase. Okay, so it's the 1% I'm going after. Okay, so the second issue, so we got this relationship. So now I said there are three parameters, alpha, Q, and H, small h, okay? And this is very nice way of putting it. You've taken out many of the uncertainties. And you can now relate this in terms of the mass of the black hole and where you are. But there are three unknowns, only one equation. I need two more equations to get anywhere. We go to observation again and try to measure the aspect ratio. Normally, in theory, what you do is you work out the balance between thermal balance and hydrostatic balance. Let's not worry about that. Let's go to observation. What can observation do for you? First of all, and there are observations of AGNs which are called reverberation map. Basically, they observe these AGN activity which fluctuates at various wavelengths in ultraviolet, and they see a little bit later, they see it in optical, and a little bit later in the infrared. And so this tells you a light travel time from here to here. You can do better than that. You can look at these lines which are produced called broad line region, and the broad line region is a region where the gas is flowing out of this disk. And you can look at various bands, UBB, and then you look at the delay time, there's spreads of delay time. And that spreads of delay time tells you something about the aspect ratio, the opening angle, because the light comes in here and goes out there and can get have a delay because their light path is different. So from there, you can work out this, I exaggerated in this plot because I want to show it. And in fact, the aspect ratio for the broad line region is less than 0.1. And the disk is considerably thinner than that. It's probably of order a few percent. And then the third parameter, so I got a second relationship. And the third relationship is this alpha parameter. Well, I can already show you that from this type of analysis, the outer region of the disk is self-gravitating. So if it's self-gravitating, it has a tendency of exciting spiral density waves, and these spiral density waves can actually give rise to angular momentum transport because of a torque. And so you can have this kind of very effective torque transport. You can work out what happens. So if the disk is in a low state, this effect is not important, then you have equivalent to MRI, and you can combine these to see whether there are some transitions from gravitational torque to MRI. By the way, the optical depths that you can work out from here is typically greater than tens. So even though this may be gravitationally unstable, it will not form stars because it can't cool on a dynamical timescale. It can't fragment and to cool on dynamical timescale. Nevertheless, there will be angular momentum transport, and by these three conditions from the population synthesis of AGN as a function of redshift from the aspect ratio determined by reverberation map and from this gravitational stability condition, you can essentially work out all of the parameters you need. There's a large dispersion in these parameters, and because observations, there's considerable amount of dispersion. Have I answered your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of them.
Keep the other ones, and it will be addressed. Okay, so what happens when you have these type of parameters? Where do these stars go? So the star goes through this disk. You have these parameters. You can work out the drag. It's very simple, okay? And you have a hard limit and soft limit. Depends on whether the relative motion is large or small compared to the surface escape velocity. And one can work out the condition under which, after a certain time t, that you can trap down into the disk. And this is done in 1993. And when Pavel Artemyevich came to me as a first generation Hubble fellow and wants to do something on planets. So I said, well, there's no planets around besides the solar system. Why don't you work on something that will get you a job? and we decided to work on AGNs and then publish this paper, and with a lot of description of all the physics that essentially laid the foundation here. And then, of course, 2 years later, and planets had hit a bonanza, and all of us has moved away from that subject. But 22 decades later, and everything that we learned from that game can be applied here. So this tells you the critical condition for trapping, but to work out the trapping rate, you still need to know something about the density. And there we once again appeal to observation. They're the coexistence of whatever is orange. These are nuclear clusters, and the black, and there are massive black holes, and they have with host galaxies parameters such as the velocity dispersion in the central cluster, I mean the bulge region. So you have an M sigma relation. From these M sigma relations, they fall on the same M sigma relation. So that tells you that if I know something about the parent galaxy, I will know something about not only the black hole, but the stellar density of the nuclear cluster. Now, the one problem caveat, is this is mostly in the region for Milky Way-like galaxies, late-type galaxies. Here are elliptical galaxies, and they don't quite overlap, okay? And that's because it's very, very hard to observe nuclear clusters there. So from there, you can work out from the phase space distribution function what fraction of stars you will trap. And doesn't matter what star, black holes, neutron stars, white dwarfs, but mostly main sequence, probably low mass. And so they can get trapped, and you have this distribution rate. You can work out the trapping rate, and that's a function of scaled with what people use as M sigma relation and scaled to parsec, okay? So this is the arbitrary value. There's a large dispersion in this. So I just want to caution you that along the way. But what is interesting is that this sigma corresponds to 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. So I'm going to work primarily around 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole, which is considerably more massive than the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Okay. But you can see here, that's what's interesting, is the capture rate is 10 to the minus, few times 10 to the minus 4 per year. Okay, so that means in the age, the active phase of AGN, let's say just for convenience, let's put it as 400 million years, characteristic duty cycle of order a couple of percent, and you already get something like 10 to the 4 or 5 of stars being trapped. Okay, incredibly efficient way of trapping the stars. And those stars' masses, still small compared to the mass of AGNs, 10 to the 8 solar masses, but it gives you an interesting parameter. Okay, so what is happening here? Once they get trapped into stars, they can accrete. And you can work out the Bondi rate is runaway accretion. The time scale decreases very rapidly with the distance from the center and because the density is high. Okay, so one can work out this is less than a million years for solar mass stars, and it runs away for more massive stars, so they can form massive stars. This is not star formation from the interstellar medium or from the disk. This is from a seed that is captured. This is very much similar to when you want to do seeding of clouds out there. And in desert, we see lots of clouds, but there's no rain, even though the humidity may exceed the saturation level. And that's because we can't do nucleation. That's very difficult. You get from very low density, get into small nuclei, it's very difficult. But once we see them, the nuclei are there, and it will rain. And this is exactly what is happening here. You put in the low mass star in the disk, boom, they start to form massive stars as if though they're young. It's rejuvenation, not birth. Okay, so, and, but this can give you trouble because if not checked, if there's no feedback, you will accrete like crazy and go over to 650 solar masses, even at one parsec region. Okay, so fortunately, that there may be outflows of some sort, okay, and especially Wolf-Rayet, and this is where I get the world expert here to help me out, and then try to work out some sort of internal models and try to look at the evolution of the system that's accreting at the same time, and that's shedding mass. And this is one of the first results Matteo has produced from this. It's very preliminary, but it's very interesting. We can go forth. The idea here, there's a possibility that you're accreting and you're ejecting both in the context of a disk with a bipolar outflow, or even in a spherical case, because if the mass is too low, there's no wind, and then you're going to accrete like crazy. But if it's too big, and then the wind becomes so strong, then you're going to hold it back. Okay, so this is an interesting issue. And in the inner region, very close to the center, it is possible for these disks to go into these regions, either in low density region or relatively high density region. So if it goes into the very high density region, in fact, some of the passing stars can actually get stripped. Okay, so they may even be able to get stripped when they go through this, and one can work out the destruction rate and the condition for disruption. And this is by looking at the condition, stabilization of Kelvin Helmholtz instability at the interface. So, is there any evidence for this fantasy? So we go to the galactic center, okay? And what is really remarkable, when you go to the galactic center, you're so close, and I was just down in UCLA last week and talking to various people, especially Andrea and Tuan Du, and when you look at this inner region within a few arc seconds, and this is the distribution of old stars, and this is the distribution of young stars. And normally, they were trying to find if they can find a density distribution that looks like what is called Bacall-Wolf. Now, let me remind you what Bacall-Wolf profile is due to. It's due to relaxation, maybe even resonant relaxation, that will enable the stars to redistribute their density distribution in the center and establish a profile. And that takes time. And you would have thought the old stars should have Bacall-Wolf, and the young stars shouldn't. But yet, young stars have some of these, the very central region. This is, you're looking at the very central arcsecond or so. And then you're getting down to 20,000 AU. And there you can see that they're elevated. So that's, in other words, all of this central region is very young. So what?
Why does it support the story? Because the galactic center is not an active AGN, and it's at 10,000.
But it was an active AGN from a Fermi bubble a few million years ago. So we just need to work out at the time of the Fermi bubble whether this could have happened.
Okay.
Okay. So you turn down the Fermi bubble, and we can reproduce this region, and that these are trapped and maybe rejuvenated. But the story is more complicated than that. If you look at the central region, there are really two populations in the very center, and this is very young, this is older, still 10 to 7 years old, and there, this one has a plane, this one doesn't. So how do you do that? And this, we model it as a possibility of multiple episodes, because the infalling material may come from the interstellar medium, and they may have very different angular momentum. And if they come in with very different angular momentum, the orientation of the disk can change, so you will trap different stars. And you also see this in very old stars, old star population, and you see that the spin vector, the angular momentum distribution vector, does evolve. And perhaps this is telling you something, and one can do this in the interstellar medium and try to form these disks with simulations of various kinds. Let me return back to the issue that what does this star do for you?
So if you have different episodes, then does that somehow imply that you have different ages and the different...
Yes.
And so is there any evidence that this is the case?
Other than the stellar age is being observed?
Yeah.
Yes, the star, they know their age. They know what kind of star their estimated age already. It's separated by 10 to 7 years.
Is that consistent with having different episodes essentially?
Well, that's
you see multiple different distributions of stars essentially that have a consistent, let's say, age with some episode that happened millions of years ago? And
yeah, this is what I'm trying to suggest, that interpretation of the observation. The observation tells you exactly what you just said. You should look at some of these stellar population analysis from people do in galactic center. It's very, very detailed, very comprehensive. And they do it with all kind of elements and, okay.
Is there any relation to the spin of the black hole?
Wait. I know that's what you're going to ask, but let's wait. Okay. So what's going to happen to this material, right? So the winds produces lots of carbon, some helium, but mostly alpha elements. And the massive star eventually evolve off the main sequence. They're not like typical type 2 supernova. They don't lose a lot of mass because they replenish. So the mass that they have is really sort of as if though they preserve their original mass. And these are the type of model, which are very idealized type of model that Weaver and Woosley have produced, and Tilleman has produced, and these are called model Cs. And you can work out from there what is the amount of metallicity that you will generate as a function of the whole star. And from these two, you can work out the metallicity production rate. They're mostly alpha enhanced. And so you can actually work out the local contamination rate. But then in the disk, and they will evolve with the disk, both because the material is flowing towards the black hole, and because there's turbulent diffusion, and one can work out this kind of contamination. We do this all the time in protostellar disks, trying to understand the evolution of the grains in this environment, we can get to a steady state and produce supersolar metallicity. So do you see that? That's what motivated us at the first place, because even back in the early 90s, there was already some claim, but this was done much better in 2006 by Nagal, and who looked at these regions, which are broad-lying region and narrow-lying region, and look primarily in carbon-4 lines. And what they found is that they find supersolar metallicity and as a function of redshift. Okay, and first of all, it's above one. Exactly how much above one is debatable, because these models are kind of model dependent on what you think of the ionization level is, electron density. But they also tend to be more metal rich than the narrow line regions, which is further out. And furthermore, the most interesting thing is that there's hardly any redshift evolution. Okay, this is kind of like you can pollute however much you like, your environment is never dirty. Okay, and so how could that be? How could you have that? So first of all, it tells you maybe all of this metallicity generation is in the proximity of the host star, and whatever is generated gets dumped onto the black hole. So it participates in the evolution of the disk material, and you find this very recent observation, one of your students, first year student, and she was an undergraduate in Peking Normal University when she did this work last year. And what she found was that when you do the same thing as in the Nagal with the more enriched Sloan digital survey, they can measure these things. And what they find is that the metallicity they determine is a function of black hole mass only, and there is no redshift evolution. Okay? And it tells you that the evidence is buried. So that massive black holes depository of local heavy element contaminants. So let's get a cartoon picture. What's going on here? You get these massive objects, and less massive, you can form binaries even a few parsec away. You can produce various byproducts, black hole, neutron star, white dwarf. And you can ask what would happen to the supernova in this environment, because the velocity is so high and the density is so high, they may explode, they get sheared out very quickly. So all of the contaminants is retained locally. So you can work out the metallicity production rate, and you can work out things, various other effects. Okay, so what happened to the black hole, the neutron stars, and the white dwarf? Okay, let's do an idealized situation. Here, it gets a little kick. And the kick is less than 200 kilometers per second, and you're going around at thousands of kilometers per second, so you never go away. And you can calculate the capture rate, so all of the black hole gets captured, a major fraction of the neutron star in the outer region can get captured, so you can calculate the capture rate, and then they can start to accrete. Now this time when they accrete, they are limited by Eddington. But that's only in luminosity, not in the mass accretion rate, because there is an efficiency factor. So the time scale for them to grow is the Salpeter time scale, taking into account of the efficiency factor and the Eddington factor, that lambda is measurement of the luminosity, not that of the accretion rate. So this could be substantially smaller than unity. So one can work out if the Salpeter time scale is larger at which location that time scale is large or small compared to the Bondi rate, and you can see whether it's limited or not. So if it is not limited, it can grow by itself. Eventually, it can open up a gap. But we don't get there. So before I go to binaries, multiples, small clusters, let me still focus on one individual black hole. So how does this black hole accrete? You ask about what happens to the spin, right? So this depends very much on the relative ratio of the Roche radius to the scale height. If the Roche radius is larger than the scale height, which means the disk is relatively cold, so that will make the boundary radius go outside the Roche radius. So when material gets accreted into the region crossing the boundary radius, and they get into the Roche radius, they will feel a torque. The gravitational field is not axisymmetric about this point, so their angular momentum is not conserved. They turn around, and in things like horseshoe orbits and whatever you like, and they form a spin around here, which is prograde. This is not universal. If you do this, in the limit that this guy is very small, the Roche radius is small compared to the thickness, then the boundary radius is actually inside the Roche radius. If that's the case, by the time you cross the boundary radius, the Roche radius is very far away. The torque from the central black hole has no effect on you. So you don't see any spin around this local region which is accreting. You get a retrograde spin. But the story is more complicated than that. What if now I am in this very hot region and there's turbulence? Turbulence is moving things around, and then I will, whether I get a positive spin, negative spin, overhead spin, or whatever, depends on the size of the eddies at the point where I have the boundary radius. So I can actually have very complicated flow, which I will come back to at later stage because you want to know the end, but I want to whet your appetite for the time being. Okay, so one can look at all of these in very in depth of these analysis. By the way, most of this work, there's probably about 15 papers in here, has not been published. And we're working on it. And every day when we work on it, we find something new. And so how do you get binaries? Now, the standard argument of binary may be differential migration. Well, these planets in the disk excite spiral density waves. They migrate. We know that since 1996. Okay, actually, since 1980. And they migrate. If they have different masses, they can capture each other, and they can get into inside the Roche radius, and then they can evolve like this. But this is not the end of the story. This is not even the main story. It's only the beginning of the story, in a sense they may be able to capture into this binary, and it's often said, in fact, even back to 10 years ago, that we have looked at this paper and looked at this problem, and that the tidal torque from this side and this side will cause the binary to shrink. But that is only important if the binary separation is comparable to the Roche radius. Otherwise, the tide from the central black hole has no influence or diminishing influence. And the Roche radius is larger than the merging gravitational radius by 9 orders of magnitude. So this effect cannot be the dominant effect. It can only be the beginning effect, not the dominant effect. But nevertheless, there could be surrounding disk around here, and you can calculate the torque. This is a little bit like common envelope evolution. So that kind of evolution one can work out, and one can simulate, and many people have, and try to figure out what is the rate for them to gradually undergo orbital decay. By the way, the eccentricity is also very limited in here. And nevertheless, if you have a disk type of configuration, you can get an eccentricity of 0.5. But what I'm going to tell you later is that you don't have this disk. There's another way to capture. Much easier, before I do that other way to capture, let me just say that you can see the interaction with the background, interaction with all this, and this type of accretion tend to drive mass ratio towards unity. Once again, it was known for more than 20 years in the binary community, binary formation community, and that's the case. And you can get semi-major axis and eccentricity determinations. And do we have any evidence of that? You look around the galactic center again. In the galactic center, there's a large population of X-ray binaries. In fact, there's a very much enhanced within the central parsec region, and you see this elevated concentration of X-ray binaries. Some of this may be due to this kind of effect. In any event, around active AGNs, we see that these active AGNs not only produce in the visual, in the radio, but they're very powerful sources of X-rays. The AGN disk model itself, if you just work out that accretion onto the massive black hole, they tend to be too cold. They only produce UV, so-called big blue bump, but they don't get to X-rays. And this may be one of the signatures that you have multiple, a large population of collapsars, and which are accreting near the Eddington limit to power the X-ray flux from any AGNs.
A question about that. There's, you can, assuming you're limited to the Eddington luminosity.
Yes.
If you look at the five of them. If you look at X-ray, so you can do this with 10 to the 5?
Yes.
Objects? Okay.
Yeah, because each one is 10 to the 38
yeah.
or 10 to the 39. Multiply by 10 to the, you can get 10 to the 44.
Okay.
Okay.
So is it, does it match with the variability in X-rays in this scenario?
Yeah, these are very, yeah, you can have very fast variabilities in, onto the individual.
Right, and it's
small black hole.
But you should average out.
Yeah, you should average out. Okay. What about Kozai effect? People talk about Kozai effect in these systems, so binary, Kozai, and all of that. It turns out in order for this binary to shrink down from 0.1 parsec down to, you know, a few gravitational radius, as I said, there's eight or nine orders of magnitude to go in scale, then that Kozai has to be two things. One is that they're almost exactly perpendicular. And second, it is that the semi-major axis has to be comparable to the Roche radius. If it's not comparable to the Roche radius, if the apogee is not near the Roche limit, the torque from the massive galaxy has no effect. So you don't have Kozai. You can only have Kozai if there are perturbers. So that makes it very difficult. And you have to line up very quickly. And the presence of any disk around the central region will detune the precession, nodal precession frequency, and therefore suppress Kozai. So what's there left? Well, now let's move on to multiples. I talked about single. I talked about binary. Let me talk about multiples.
So those are processes that, for example, would happen also in protoplanetary disks. Right?
Absolutely.
So do we have any, I don't even know if there is a way to detect binary planets around stars. I mean,
well,
we have a lot of planets.
We have the fact that we grow, it was from planetesimals. You anticipate my slide, okay? It's the fact that we grow is from these mergers, giant impacts, and grows from small bodies to large bodies. The only difference there is that the physical size compared to the Roche radius is 1% or less, okay? But the individual black holes compared to their Roche radius and when they cross, 10 to the 9 or so, okay? So they don't collide, but something interesting happened, just wait for the next slide. Okay, so what do we know about planets? And there are these things called planetesimal growth. By coagulation, by collisions, you can work out this coagulation because on the one hand, they excite each other's eccentricity, but they also damp, the disk also damp their eccentricity, so you can work out the excitation time scale, the damping time scale, you can work out the equilibrium eccentricity, is typically the radial excursion is less than their individual Roche radius. So that means that they are in nearly circular orbit. When they grow, they will start to influence the other companions nearby, and they will start to cause orbit crossing, and then they will grow. But there is a growth limit. This growth limit is called dynamical isolation. You have a feeding zone plus minus 5 Roche radius on each side. You clear up all of this material into one or two of these bodies, and then you get into dynamical isolation. This is well done in planetesimal formation in the context of planet formation. We could do this with 10^5, 10^4, 5 black holes, and you can actually produce 100 of these clusters, each one with 100 of these little seed black holes. So as they grow, individual black holes' Roche radius expands because their mass is increasing. So here is semi-major axis, just idealized. This is time. They start to overlap each other's orbit. They start to capture. And this is just a simple illustration to show you they start to cluster and pair. Okay? And this is just an idealized simulation. And this is the kind of picture that we have developed for 40 years in planet formation. And more recently, there are these issues. People talk about convergent migration, migration trap, because you showed me this very briefly, these ideas. And you can do that. But this is not trapping of two seed black holes, a cluster. Okay, and you can get these cluster environment. You can see what happens when they get into these type of cluster environment. And I have two clusters here, just for illustration. These are the black holes that go in and out of the cluster. And so what happens, that is, you can see that as they evolve, some get kicked out, but because the gravitational binding of this massive black hole is so strong, the velocity, Keplerian velocity here, exceeds several thousand kilometers per second. They never go very far. So as a result, if I do it with radius, you know, semi-major axis, and all that, and just to get you a better illustration, and you can see that there are some clusters, some members go from one to another, and they go through some exchanges. So these clusters are ephemeral. It's kind of like, you know, our association with universities as an undergraduate, as a graduate, as a postdoc, and as a faculty. We move around, okay? And quite often that we converge, at least temporarily, in one unit for a while. And then we go off somewhere else, and during that time, we enter into collaboration, okay? So there are these type of process that's taking place, and then inside these cluster, they also accrete gas. These are gravitational potentials, and the eccentricity can get damped along the way. And so here is an illustration that you can have a small cluster here. This group is just focusing on a few multiples down below here in this cluster. And they're evolving, and what happened during this evolution is that these guys will undergo the typical type of thing like that, and somebody gets kicked out, and the binary gets tightened. So you can look at the binary tightening time scale, and they will keep on tightening, okay? But because it's so dense, the eccentricity is not that high. Okay, you can go through this type of process, and also because there's gas around, eccentricity gets damped. So that, as I said, the cluster in this environment can accrete, and as a result of accretion, the cluster can become more and more tightened, and the cluster can also undergo migration and as they spiral towards the center. But because they are tightening, they can preserve their integrity and as they go towards the center and with some gas that is accreted. So this is not yet the story of the spin. So here is the story of the spin. So the binary separation, they become a binary when they're inside their Roche radius, and it's 0.01 parsec, and they have to go a long way. So because they're going a long way, the binary separation is often very small compared to the scale height, and very small compared to the turbulent background. You don't actually notice very much of the background spin state here. So, and these turbulent gas would change the orientation of the circumbinary disk, and it will change the orientation of the individual disk, and it will change the coupling with the central black hole. Okay? And there's a lot of moving parts, and we know this happens in the context of star formation, because here is a binary star side by side to each other, and one disk is edge on, another disk is face on. Okay? And clearly on that scale, some angular momentum variation has taken place. And we do this in simulations, we can see this and type of evolution that's changing. And in the region where you're dumping angular momentum the opposite way, you actually reverse the spin. You contract the disk, you can have accretion rate that is non-steady, and you can work out. You can even work out, ideally, all of the coupling between the binary and the disk, and the disk is changing, the binary is changing, and the individual circumstellar disk is changing, and so you can work out the time scale for these changes. So basically, the time scale for changes is all related to the Saupeter time scale, okay? Except in the context of spin, you may have an additional enlargement of your sphere influence because of lens tearing effect. And so you can work out all of this and analyze each step along the way. You can compare it with the gravitational radiation, at which point that you can shrink them down to the level where gravitational radiation will start to dominate and take off. Okay, you become decoupled, and basically you can work out the decoupling by looking at the rate of this semi-major axis shrinkage and gravitational radiation shrinkage, and you can also look at eccentricity. So how big is the spin you may expect? So that depends on whether most of the mass growth is by mergers versus by accretion of gas. If you accrete the gas, because gas is coming in random directions, they generally cancel out. Okay, so there's very little angular momentum. But if you do it by merger, because as you said, the previous merger, you already got a spin, and then you ended up with the next merger, things will change. Okay, so that ratio on average, you can look at the black hole spin, and that ratio is roughly, okay, this the maximum spin parameter times the ratio of the Saupeter time to the AGN lifespan. The Saupeter time may be less than 10 to the 7 years, so this could be of order 0.1 or less. And so the spin rate you expect is much smaller, because when you accrete the gas, and they can have very little spin. But this is only on average, so there would be, you know, occasional spins that you can get from that. Okay, so length scales. Okay, so look at the massive black hole. We're talking about 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. We can scale this a little later. And this is where the disk extends out to a few parsecs. Okay, and then you can ask for a single star, at which point they undergo tidal disruption, and it's right around a few AU, and you can ask, What about the possibility of removal and TDE effect and many of these type of process? We can trap them all the way down to this region. And the ISCO is down here. Okay, so what about the stars? Let's put in just for, you know, for example, 30 by 30 binary black holes, and under what condition that, what, you know, what feeding zone do for you. And they will give you separation, they will give you compact configurations, you can get into an average distance between the individual black holes in this cluster. What about, you know, differential migration, when would this operate, and you can also work out from there. You can look at the effect of COSI, can get you down to here, but the binary exchange, you can go considerably down because that the scattering, the gravitational scattering does not kick you out unless you're very close, you know, you're almost right on top of each other, and the gravitational radiation will long have caused them to shrink and eject them. And then there's also this possibility of circumbinary disks. So this may go into these type of distribution. I have not yet looked into all of the implications because there are many moving parts, and this may also tell you something about recoils. Is there an upper mass limit? Can we go for it indefinitely? We may be able to and go considerable amount, but if you get too massive, then migration will start to play a role. And let me talk a little bit about what happens when you get too massive. When you get too massive, and basically, as we know in planets, you'll eventually open up a gap. Once you open up a gap, the gas supply to this region is reduced, okay? And but it also provides an angular momentum transport from here to here, from here to here, okay? So there is a coupling between the disk and this cluster or intermediate mass black hole. But this object is still embedded in the stellar cluster. So it will undergo dynamical friction and it will undergo orbital decay because it will give angular momentum to the cluster. Okay? As a result, it will move in. When it moves in, it's going to push. It's going to push the disk gas with it, and it's going to clear out the disk gas along the way. And this is possibility of a way to switch off AGNs, and the time scale for here is about 10 to the 8 years. And along the way, if you have still lots of leftover black holes, seed black holes, you also get pushed in because of resonant capture and migration, forced migration. Okay, so is there any evidence to suggest that the AGN active phase is lasts for 10 to the 8 years? We can do these things called quasars on quasars. This first quasar has created an equivalent of a H2 region, actually it's helium-2 region, and then you look at a more distant quasar, and you look at the absorption lines along this way, so you can work out the extent of this helium-2 region. You can figure out the time scale for that to persist on this is of order 10 to the 8 years. You can also do this with the population synthesis models that people have done for AGNs. Is of order 10 to the 8 years. So this may be a way to do it. Is there any evidence of a cluster around the galactic center? Well, there is this region called IRS 13E, and which is supposed to have a mass of order 10 to the 4 solar masses. It's not clear whether they're all bound to each other, but if they are, it's 10 to the 4 solar masses. So the mass ratio between this object and the central black hole is 0.002. What is the mass ratio of 0.001, Jupiter to the Sun. Okay, so here we have an equivalent of a Jupiter. Let's see if the Jupiter had an effect on the formation of the solar system. Jupiter has a small eccentricity. At the time when there was a dear solar nebula around, it precesses because of the gravitational potential due to the disk. As the disk gas goes away, and its precession reduces. So that precession triggers what is called a secular resonance, and in which that the precession frequency Jupiter has matches with the precession Jupiter causes on the asteroids, and then it removes angular momentum from the asteroid, excites their eccentricity, and this is the way to clear out the asteroid belt. So you can do this. What happened in here? We know there's a Fermi bubble. So at some point around a few million years ago, there was a disk. And what if that disk goes away like this, and if you had this precession of this object, and what would happen? It would excite the eccentricity of all the disk stars. It turns out when people try to do this without this object, just by two-body relaxation, and they produce from two-body relaxation and resonant relaxation the green dots, okay, as a function of semi-major axis of all these stars, and the eccentricity, the major eccentricity is the red. So the major eccentricity is considerably larger than the standard theory of stellar dynamics would predict. So one way to get that is having this so-called sweeping secular resonance and during the depletion of the disk by the Fermi bubble, that we are able to excite this type of process.
It looks like the eccentricity seems to get larger than
yes.
the green dots only at
That's
larger
right.
area.
That's very good, because this object's projected separation is already very large. So it's in the orbit near it, that's when the secular resonance is strongest. You're absolutely correct. There is that dependence. Is there any other thing that's interesting? Well, we know that there are all these hypervelocity stars. Okay, people talk about the Hills mechanism of binary exchange. What if this secular resonance could have caused, because of this secular resonance, and you could cause something to fly out through this type of process because the eccentricity gets very large and it goes through a slingshot. Now, how do you test that idea? And one way to test that idea is that if you look among the Gaia data, you look for binaries. You look for binaries. The Hills mechanism, and that you have a binary, the binary cannot survive because the binary is the kicker. You lose one of the binary, you go out, okay? But if you have an intermediate mass cluster here and you do this, then you can kick binaries out. So, it's a difficult task to do, but this would be something interesting. Let's finally talk about LIGO. Thank you for being so patient. Okay, so, the question is, what can we do for you, or what can you do for us? Okay, so let's make some estimates, because I give you this story for 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole, but all of the story, the disk, the cluster, everything is coupled to the host galaxy's poverty. So I can integrate. If I know this is the trapping rate, this is the cosmic volume, okay? I know the trapping rate at any given cosmic epoch. I can work out in terms of the mass of the host galaxy or the velocity dispersion, sigma is the same. Okay, so I can do the sigma relationship, and I can work out, integrate that, and try to work out to the event where the event's LIGO gets to, and see what I can get. This is very rough, and let me go more exact in a minute. Okay, so basically, there are 10 to the 7 Milky Way-like galaxies, per cubic gigaparsec, and you can work out how many of them are in the AGN phase, you can work out the trapping time, you can work out the trapping rate, the merging rate, and you get a number that is of order one per week, but this is just cooking. There's so much uncertainty in here. I don't, you know, I'm not proud of this kind of argument. Let's do something a little bit more exact. Well, when you look at these distribution functions in terms of the host galaxy, well, we know about quasar luminosity function from years of analysis people have done as a function of redshift, and then you know about nuclear clusters, so you can work out from them, you can integrate all of these things, and M sigma relations, and you can then put in this, you know, into the context of all of these populations and work out what you get. And you again get something similar to that, but a large spread in uncertainty. Okay, so I am not going to claim that we can reproduce the population. I don't even begin to claim that. I would say that maybe there's a bit of a market share. Okay, so the take home message is that AGN disks, the first thing I want to say is that AGN disks are remarkably similar to protostellar disks. And AGN physics is remarkably similar to planet formation physics. Okay, from my perspective, this is very interesting because I work in both fields and I enjoy trying to solve these microphysics puzzles. And the young stars that you see in the center of the Milky Way is not young. They just appear to be young. They are rejuvenated, okay? And then supernova leads to the formation of C black holes with a few solar masses and contaminated. These are the primary Kuipers. Maybe that the presence of a population of these collapsars around these AGN disks can provide us some estimate on the electromagnetic counterparts of these C black holes here. And they're retained, they grow, and they migrate and capture partners close to the black hole, analogous to planet formation. What I described to you should not be a surprise to anybody who works on planets. That's how we did it. And then single and multiple C black holes, the mass spin and orbit of angular momentum evolves as they mutually interact with each other and they accrete turbulence. So the angular momentum vector depends on the ratio of the Salpeter time and the active phase. And so it's relatively slow. So, and this is kind of event, which I very roughly estimate, and I hope when we develop into a more mature state, I will come to sit at the feet of Emmanuel and ask if he can turn on his machine to see whether there is some prediction can be made, or at least some cooking can be made. But the most important thing compared to stellar evolution is that they are formed in metal-rich environment, not metal-poor environment. You can probably do this eventually with LIGO, and even though that we kind of home in on the actual position, but there's a redshift information. And in the low redshift region, maybe we know the exact distance, and we can try to see whether there's any correlation with AGN that is in the active phase. And eventually, when LISA comes along, there is a link between this, and because of the intermediate mass black hole would move in, and there will be some prediction that can be made there, but I will be safe because I will be long dead. Thank you.
So I think one of the predictions of this, you talk about the rapid growth of stars and so on. You're talking maybe 10 to 5 stars per AGN duty cycle.
In 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole.
For the 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. So that predicts a pretty high rate of supernovae. I know that given the natural variability of AGN, it may not be easy to see, but how does that square with observations?
I think the supernovae would be, well, the only thing I can give you is that we were motivated by that to generate the metals.
Yes. Oh,
okay, so that was the thing, but you can't see it because it's embedded in this environment. It would be very difficult to see it. The best you can see is the X-rays produced from the remnants.
Okay, and then
I think that's the only thing that, you know, if you have a large population, you look at all these things, you see spotted X-rays around these AGN discs. That would be a signature.
That makes sense. And then I also wanted to kind of follow up on something Alberto asked, which is that if the X-rays are genuinely produced almost entirely by the 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 embedded remnants, then since they would be surely uncorrelated, one would expect a very low level of variability in the X-rays. But I had the impression that the X-ray variability from AGN was much more than the 10 to the minus 2 level. So.
Sure. There are many of these details need to be explored further. I agree. Yes?
Just that, the point you make at the end, so would we expect a correlation with active AGN?
Yes.
But
yes.
So there is no delay?
No, because during the active AGN, you have to have a disk there already. Okay, so there will be some delay. You got to get a few object trapped there already, right? It's an ongoing process, okay? So, but if I see an active AGN, I would say that its age is probably 10 to 8 years old. It's already, you know, at least adolescent. It's unlikely that I would see it at its infancy,
yeah.
Right? So if it's already at the adolescent stage, and then these statistics will work.
Most of the mergers will occur if you have a disk.
Yes.
And so if you have a disk, you have an AGN.
Yes, that is very good. Yes.
Yes. That's right. The rate is probably low.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. When the disk goes away, there's still a population of something left, and the rate will decline. Okay. And that decline I have not yet worked out. But those will be something that's very interesting to look.
But for example, if this is the only channel, if it were the only channel, then the correlation with AGN should be pretty strong.
Yes. And as I said, I, you know, backpedal by saying that I'm not after 100% market share. And even the few percent market share, and this, your observation can do a lot for the AGN evolution. And especially, I believe this mechanism, there's an analogous mechanism to all of this that enables us to form 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole within at redshift 7 or earlier. Okay, and there is a capture of the cores of dwarf galaxies and many of these processes and the accretion trapping and then the orbital evolution, many of these things will work, and this is something that is we're still looking at.
There was a paper by Hinzolf and others trying to quantify what level, what percentage of live events can be associated to a channel like this through correlation with AGN for the observed events. And you probably need, I don't remember numbers, but hundreds of events to get down to maybe 10% or something like that.
I mean, I guess what's the AGN density on the sky?
Well, this is what I worked out here in this. This is the rough number, right? These are the rough numbers, okay? And in terms per cubic parsec and all of that, you can work out from there and the rates and many things associated with that. Okay, and that turns out in the most optimistic level, you can get about one event per week. So.
So I remember Zoltan also talking about this extra signature that will be characterized with LIGO if some of this are in LIGO. Where you can actually, because you will see the one that enter LIGO, some that are in LIGO band, but there will be an effect of like a Doppler shift due to the fact that you're actually rotating around AGN. So if that's the case, you'll be able to determine the one that entered LIGO that were around an AGN even without having two other disks and active AGN associated.
Sorry. How do the timescales work out?
Yeah, I forgot the details, but it seems like it's possible to do it with LISA.
Well, if they are close and they have to be close, they stand on the pole.
Right, they have to be close.
You can see the effect of the acceleration along the orange on the pole in the LISA waveform. I think Nicola also.
Yeah, we also looked at this in case on the,
So I don't know exactly.
How close you need to be to see the doctor in LISA.
The idea is the orbital time has to be a few years or something, and then it works.
Well, yeah, I guess, I mean, it has to be, so that you can see the acceleration in the 1 year or 2 years.
Right.
Emanuele, you said you're a paper, so.
Yes, I.
And you just signed it.
Nah.
Just wrote it.
Writing obsessively to the talk.
No, you get a bound on the radius, but.
Yeah, okay.
By the way, Matteo has alerted me that if this rumor about the 100 solar mass black hole is correct, maybe this is a good channel.
I think the way to put it is that this will be a way to populate the gap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know what Manuel Alex told us the other day is that this will be an environment also where takes up problem because of what you said.
Yeah.
The escape velocity is much larger than global cluster.
Right.
So.
And then the point is you can also reuse the binaries over and over again because they never, even if they leave the system, they never go away and they get captured into the next cluster and then they keep on doing it.
So you might have said that in the 2000. So have people worked out, for example, you see the black hole or a few black holes or a cluster, they probably merge, they will accrete along the way, they will drift to the center, and some of them will merge eventually with the center.
Yes, they will.
So have people worked out these numbers and whether there are predictions for LISA?
Well, this is, yeah, but once you open up a gap, it's relatively fast. Okay, and because it's a combination of, you know, that you're more massive, you're interacting with all of the cluster stars, and you're moving, and in addition to the planet disk interaction, you have this additional contribution, and that, you know, that's also something very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, optimally placed to see like 100 or 1,000 solar mass black holes merging.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wait. Those we will see.
Yeah, and if you can see that, then you know this is a very powerful probe.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah. Okay. Any unanswered questions? I guess. I think we are essentially past the time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.